Curtis Granderson went 3-for-4 today to up his on-base percentage to .372 with a .443 slugging.
I feel like I would want that guy in my lineup.
I think there's a case to be made that he's the biggest piece. I mean, it's either him or Machado, depending on what you think of position players, on this market, period.
We even have Monty Python attempting to throw the holy hand grenade as an impression of what John managed to do.
And welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, episode number 105. Come for the anxiety, stay for the baseless, despairing speculation. I'm your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I am joined once again by Joshua Howsam. Josh, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Did you take a week off from the team while you were on vacation?
I did, yeah.
I feel like I can take a week off from the team even not being on vacation. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. But the starting rotation is a good starting rotation. So if you wanted to watch the first 6 or 7 innings, we can talk about that. Randall Grichuk has returned with a vengeance, and Teoscar Hernandez has moved to left field. We could talk about that. And then there is the whole issue of these other guys who are on the team who need at bats, but I don't know where they go exactly. A friendly reminder that as much as I love Yanhervis Solarte and Aled Mestias, they are not Josh Donaldson and Troy Tulowitzki, and we have questions about those guys. Marcus Stroman, would he be back soon? Would we want him back? Who knows? The Blue Jays have a problem. It's surrounding 5 runs, and they also have a problem because the only team they can beat is the Baltimore Orioles. I have a do-over and a gold star for John Axford, which doesn't make any sense until I explain it later. And we have a listener who would like to stump you, Josh, and he has shown up in my mentions and giving me a really obscure trivia question. So he got me in a soft spot. He got me in a soft spot because it was one of my favorite players of all time as part of the trivia question. So that's not a hint, even. Let's just start with the starting rotation. The Jays, what was there supposed to be their strength? In the spring training and the preseason, Josh, what was the number one thing we were happy about with this team?
Starting rotation.
Yep. And now they're back.
They are back. Going back to the last game of the Tiger series, they have made now, I believe that's 10 games since the end of that Tiger series. And 8 of them have been not necessarily quality starts by the measure, because a couple of them were 5 innings, but very good starts.
Yeah. And that even includes a start of what, Sam Gavilio versus the Yankees?
Yeah, he shut them down, and he struggled against Tampa because naturally.
Absolutely. But,
Garcia and Gavilio each had one not so good start. And then the rest of them, the other 8 starts have been fantastic. J Happ didn't give up a run in either of them.
Yeah, an ERA of 0. Even a run average of 0. That's, can't beat that.
I guess he gave up one unearned run. I apologize.
But
no unearned runs in either of those 2 games.
You can only marginally beat that by never letting them hit the ball, I guess. J Happ is doing wonderful things to boost his trade value. I'll give him that.
We'll get into that a bit more later. But, I mean, this is kind of what we were sort of hoping for this team, right? That they would, this pitching would turn around, and it has. And it was, unfortunately, it's the only thing that has, which again, we'll continue with. But I wanted to also touch on Estrada specifically, because I think it might have been the last time I was on the podcast, because obviously I wasn't here last week. We talked about how his ball wasn't rising as much.
Mm-hmm. And then he had a good start while you were away, and I felt bad discussing him while you were away.
And then he had another good start. He had 2 of them.
So we can talk about him again.
And guess what?
His ball's rising.
The ball's rising again. Both starts, his fastball averaged over 13 inches of fighting gravity, which is back to the, you know, the levels from since he joined the Blue Jays, 2015 to last year. And that's a huge difference for him. And what do you know? He was great twice in a row.
It works. Is it? So, I mean, ultimately, I guess we're never going to get a 100% answer, but it does seem like it might be a feel thing for him in terms of, you know, just how the ball is coming out of his hand. And if he gets it right and he can get locked in, we have a, you know, a very good quality you know, middle of the rotation guy in Marco Estrada. You do worry, mm-hmm. though, because the last couple of years, for various reasons, it hasn't been locked in. And those haven't been like, oh, one start not locked in. It's been three or four in a row, and you kind of start to think, oh, is he going to get it back? And it looks like, I think, you after one more start of even decent performance, as long as that, you know, that fastball keeps doing what you're talking about, maybe he has got it back, and he's you know, he's on a good run again.
Yeah. So we'll see.
It's interesting to note, and we'll get back to Marcus Stroman, like I said, later, but that this run of quality starts has been done without Marcus Stroman in the rotation, who we thought was going to be an anchor for this team as well. So it's still not how we drew it up in spring training.
Nope. Sangavilio being in the rotation, I mean, he wasn't even on the team at the beginning of spring training.
You take what you can get sometimes. So the other developments that we have on the lineup side, we have Randall Grichuk returning from the disabled list. And at one point I heard Wilner today say that he was 9 for his last 20, which is fantastic. And then the sort of domino effect has pushed Teoscar Hernandez, who's very tough to put on the bench, over to left field. And defensively, he's certainly, I mean, on the radio they tell us he's doing way, way better. I would certainly say he's done a lot less damage, and he seemed to be able to uncork some pretty accurate throws from that corner.
Yeah, when he actually throws the ball as opposed to lobbing it in, which we talked about on one of the previous podcasts, he's got a pretty decent arm, and we've seen evidence of it a few times. It's just the occasional, I don't know what to call it, brain cramp? I don't know, but whatever it is, it's better, at least, I guess, in left field.
What do they used to say on the Bugs Bunny cartoons? The lackadaisical attitude?
I mean, I don't think it was like an effort thing, though. I think it was just every now and then it would just disappear. Like, he wouldn't know what exactly he was supposed to be doing. But, you know, I think comfort level plays in there, too, right? Being able to, I mean, the more you play in the bigs, the easier it becomes.
Yeah, I think maybe knowing the throws are going to be shorter, or knowing that you've got the play sort of, the runner's always running towards you in left field, right? So maybe when you bring your head up and you're looking at the play, you know, that's approaching you, maybe for some guys that just is a confidence factor of, okay, I can see where he really is, and I know how long I have to get him now because I've got a different perspective on it. Because I imagine, you know, watching a runner run away from you at second, that guy literally looks like he's running away from you when you're trying to make that throw to third base.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, and this is, like you mentioned at the top of this little segment, this is the cascading effect of having Grichuk return, because Grichuk is an excellent defender in right field. And we've seen evidence of that multiple times since he returned, a bunch of highlight plays and sliding catches, not ones where he's falling and injuring himself. And since his return, he's hitting .333 with a .368 on base and a .667 slugging. This is entering today. It doesn't include today's 0-for-3, but, you know, if he's hitting at all, which that obviously is very, very good hitting, then he's a must start every day just because of what he brings on both sides of the ball.
Yeah. I mean, this is a guy who, if you're looking at someone who you need a day in center, and your options are who all the Blue Jays have, if you want to give Pilar a day off, I don't hesitate to put Randall Grichuk in center for a day. He knows how to get to the ball. And, you know, he certainly doesn't suffer from the noodle arm that Curtis Granderson has by any measure.
No, and he's shown in the very recent past, as recently as last year, that he can play center field just fine.
Yeah, so it's good to have him where he's not hitting 100.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't that guy.
Yeah, his OPS is 200 points higher than when he went on the disabled list. It'd just be interesting to see what guy he is, right? He's not this either. He's never going to hit .333 over the course of a season. But as long as he settles in to what we thought we were getting as he came into the year, a guy who's going to hit, I don't know, .250 with a bunch of home runs and a bunch of strikeouts, that's fine as long as he's playing the defense.
And the funny part is, like, a .250 average is basically league average now. I know it doesn't seem like it, but that's where averages have gone. So yeah, an average guy with some power, I'll take it in a heartbeat. Who can hit lefties and righties?
He gets to play. Now, of course, the cascading effect you mentioned, right? So it moves Teoscar Hernandez to left.
Curtis Granderson guy.
Yeah. Now, Curtis Granderson went 3-for-4 today to up his on-base percentage to .372 with a .443 slugging.
I feel That's like I would good. Want that guy in my lineup.
Yeah. And if you were to ask most Jays fans, like, okay, great, that's an easy decision. Those two guys play, Granderson DHs. Well, over the last month, there's this other guy in the lineup, Kendrys Morales, who has been hitting pretty much the way the team hoped. This is exactly 1 month of games. I don't know why, rather than picking arbitrary, more arbitrary endpoints like May 19th, he's hitting .303 with a .341 on base and a .461 slugging.
It sounds like almost an 800 OPS.
802.
Well, you know, that's a good problem to have, I guess.
It is a good problem to have, and I guess the one we sort of thought they might have when Teoscar Hernandez first came up and these guys were coming, not everyone was hurt. But it'll be interesting to see how they manage it because... No, like mentioned, that Morales has been hitting lately. Over his last 5-6 starts, he's got 10 hits. And so they have to get these guys through. And with the way the offense is scuttling, it'll be interesting to see how creative they get.
Yeah, well, once we run down everything, I think we're going to get to the offense's scuttling issue. scuttling. Maybe it's just scuttling away.
It makes more sense.
Yeah. So I guess part of the problem is, as I mentioned prior, the left side of the infield is also not how we drew it up on paper at the beginning of spring training, because when I look over there, I see Yankee Hervis Solarte and I see Aledmys Diaz, and these guys are fun. They can occasionally do some really, really cool things. I mean, Solarte has some pop, makes the occasional good play. Diaz is, like we've said several times, legitimate shortstop, can knock one out of the ballpark, and they play the game with a lot of energy, especially Solarte. But he's not Josh Donaldson, and certainly Diaz is not Troy Tulowitzki, even the Tulowitzki we had maybe in 2015 when he, you know, 2016.
Yeah.
This is a problem.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And we might be getting a solution with the Donaldson part of it because he's starting to rehab games and he might be back even as soon as this weekend. But it is not the way this was drawn up. I mean, Troy Tulowitzki is still not close to coming back, which is surprising to me, not to you, obviously, based on the conversations we've had. But he's taking ground ball, he's taking batting practice, but there's still no specific timetable for his return. You know, Aledmys Diaz was supposed to be the backup. And Yandy Solarte is supposed to be the backup. And with them both playing, it's just, it's glaring.
Yeah, I mean, Troy Tulowitzki belongs in a milk cart at this point.
Yeah, although he did make an appearance on the field. Because they were down in Tampa and they rehab in Dunedin, but it's, you know, it's a problem. And you know, Tulowitzki, for all his faults, he's a better defender than Diaz, as solid as Diaz has been, and his offensive floor is what Diaz is doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
His absolute floor.
I just realized in our injury update, we did not include the Vlad Jr. most unfortunate injury update. How do we miss that in our list of things to talk about? Because that's the other guy who showed up in Dunedin.
Yeah, he's out for a month
at least, hopefully. Yeah, no. A month is super cautious.
Yeah, no superstar slugger reinforcement coming in the near future.
Not
of course,
that we,
given what we just said, where would he play?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think he's ready at shortstop, so that is a problem.
I was referring to what we said about the DH and outfield spots.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It's the only spot you've got open is shortstop. Yeah.
Second base?
Would he be the biggest second baseman ever to play as a rookie at that location? He made Kendrys Morales look like a lightweight in the pictures that they took on the field.
He's a big boy.
He is... wide. And I mean, I'm sure all of it is power, given everything that he can do. But yeah, what a specimen of a human being. Unfortunately, he has something wrong. Was it his knee that he's... I think it's a knee
tendon. It was his leg, yeah. Patella tendon.
Most unfortunate. Everyone is like, oh no, the world is sucky because Vlad is hurt. Okay, I get it. But of all the times and places that I would like him to be hurt is a time when there's no pressure on him for to come back too soon because of an injury.
Yeah, he's in the minor leagues. And, you know, it's not like he was needing to do a whole lot to prove that he could play and or that his development is going to be overly hindered by this.
Yeah.
It's not. I'd much rather this happen than him already being up in the 40 men and or in the major leagues, and then he starts accruing service time while not playing, and it's just while the team's losing. Like, everything would have been bad if that happened, like what happened to Anthony Alford last year.
Yeah, same deal. Like, I mean, you, and this is a guy where you look at maybe Dalton Pompey, and we've said it a bunch of times, well, Dalton Pompey needs to get his reps to show what he can do. Vlad Jr. doesn't really need to get his reps for 600 or 550 plate appearances to prove anything this year. Maybe no. His reps at third, but not at the plate. That was the whole digression there that I wasn't planning on, but we are sad in the sense that I don't like to see him hurt. Because, hey, one injury can always lead to another, but I'm not so sad because, like you just said, there are a whole lot of other ways that could have gone south had he been somewhere else. Injuries.
Yep.
JD, you said, was coming back. Tulo is a complete mystery. Marcus Stroman had a start tonight, as in Dunedin. It did not look fantastic, but, hey, he's on the mound.
Yeah, the minor league numbers mean nothing. We've talked about this before. I think it might have been in an Extra Pellets episode about... It was, actually, when we were talking about the minors, and these guys go down and have screwy performances. It's just about getting on the mound and throwing. It'll be interesting what happens when he comes back, which I'm guessing, given the way Stroman is, and he's going to want to come back after one or two rehab starts.
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay, well, not one, two or three. Who goes out?
I think if... Gavilio has one more bad start, that's the easy decision.
If he doesn't.
It'll
still be him, but it'll be an interesting decision because Jaime Garcia has been the guy who's been the worst of the five.
Yes. How many times have the Blue Jays come across this? Okay, well, first of all, these problems tend to have a way of working themselves out. I always say that.
Yes.
Given that situation and not wishing any ill upon any of the five starters, how many times have the Blue Jays had something like this and suddenly decided that a six-man rotation would be prudent for like 2 weeks, and then inevitably something works itself out when they try and go to a six-man rotation?
Has that happened a lot? I don't know.
I think it's happened like two times in the last 3 or 4 years where
they did it for sure when they brought in Liriano.
Yep.
And then they eventually just said, Dickie, you're not pitching anymore. But yeah. I don't think that'll be the case here. This is just my guess, is that Gavilio will go back into being the long man in the pen, like the role he had before he got shoved into the rotation.
Makes sense. And then you move Biagini back to the minors to figure out what the heck Joe Biagini's doing these days.
Yeah, which we have a question about, so we'll get to that in a bit more depth later, but yeah.
So Stroman still, I mean, there's still a week and a half, right, then to decide what's up with Stroman, provided everything proceeds with his rehab according to plan.
Yeah.
All right, let's get serious. This team has a problem. And the problem is about 5 runs.
Oh, yeah.
If this team scores 5 runs, what is its record?
25-1.
If this team scores 4 runs or less, what is its record?
5-37.
I feel like the Mariners are not going to have any kind of record that resembles that when you talk about 4 runs and 5 runs. Like, this bubble, this magic sweet spot of 5 runs, it really shouldn't be like that with a good starting rotation and anything resembling a decent bullpen.
The Mariners are 18-19 when they give up 4, when they score 4 or fewer runs. That's the second best record, actually, with that. No one is above 500 in that scenario. The Yankees are at 500.
What is the Blue Jays' actual winning percentage? What does 5-37 work out to?
That would be a winning percentage of 156. Wait, no, sorry, that's wrong. I hit that number wrong. That's 119.
119. So they win 11% of their games if they don't score 5 runs.
Yeah, the only team that's worse is Cincinnati at 111.
And I might remind you that Cincinnati is horrible at everything except having Joey Votto on their team.
Yeah.
That's just... it's uncanny, but it's also, I think maybe it's indicative of the fact that the Blue Jays don't have enough, luck, ingredients, something. It gives me no faith in this team going forward.
I don't really understand it. So the reason that something like that would come about, and you'd think of it, would be, so it sort of harkens back to the 2015 Blue Jays, who had the similar kind of problem where when they didn't score, they didn't win because their pitching was bad. But with the starting pitching turning around, they're still losing these games. So I don't really know. Yeah, because so in 2015, the Jays were 16-56 when they scored four or fewer runs. But that was still 100 points higher by winning percentage.
Is there a mental block? Is there a mental block on the part of, I don't know, the pitchers or the hitters when you get to the late innings and you've only scored two or three runs and the other team is threatening? And, you know, is something psychological where these guys are like, man, this isn't going to be enough? Whereas the Mariners, who happen to be fantastic in one-run games this year, maybe they're thinking, you know what? We could just lock this down. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. Because obviously there's no written explanation for weirdness like this.
Yeah, I don't know what the reasons are for it. Again, you would think this would be related to a pitching staff, but the pitching staff has, like I said, it's turned it around, and I don't know. It shouldn't be this bad, because this is atrocious.
Which is to say, whether it stays this bad going forward might not matter, because they have burned probably a dozen opportunities there to win what you would call a very winnable game, right? Like, I mean, if they were, 17 and 25 or something like that, you'd be like, well, that sucks, but that's kind of how it goes. But their record would be at 500. They've that water has gone under the bridge.
Yep. It's bad.
So here we are in the middle of June-ish. I think, does this team have to sell or not, is the real question.
So this, once again, goes back to the last podcast I was on. My final thought was looking ahead at the schedule and saying, okay, so there could be some chance to pick up some more ground, because they had three against the Tigers, four against the Orioles, three against the Rays, all bad teams, with two games against the Yankees in the middle of that. In that stretch, including the Yankees games, they went 5-7. So in a time where they had to go, you know, pick up some real games, 5-5 against those bad teams, they probably had to go at least 8-2 or 7-3 to make up any ground. They didn't. So they've just fallen farther back. And that's really, I think, points to, yeah, they need to start selling, because look at the teams they have coming up now. Washington, Atlanta, the Angels, the Astros, and then the Tigers come back at the beginning of the month. So it's not getting any easier.
If you wanted to ever make a prop bet on a no-hitter, by the way, I think Max Scherzer's start coming up this week would be worth a dollar somewhere. If it's, you know, if you're paying at those 1,000-to-1 odds, I would take that bet.
I have tickets to that game and I can't go, which is very annoying.
Well, I mean, chances are, you never know with starting pitching, but chances are, if they're going to get eviscerated, that would seem to be the guy to do it.
Yeah, but, and you know, Ross Atkins was on, I can't remember who he was speaking to recently, but he said that the trade market is starting to take shape a lot earlier this year than it has in the past 2 years of his role as the general manager, which implies that people are starting to make offers on their guys. And I think this three-game sweep at the hands of the Rays that we just witnessed might be the thing that pushes them towards finally actually listening to those offers.
I can see it, because you also now got a very good idea of what Jay Happ is, which is probably the biggest piece you're going to be able to move, right?
I think there's a case to be made that he's the biggest piece. I mean, it's either him or Machado, depending on what you think of position players, on this market, period.
Well, yeah, because you could make the argument that Jay Happ is a number 2/3 starter without too much difficulty, and he has been consistently for the last 2 or 3 years. And from my understanding, you look around and nobody else like that is even out there.
Yeah, since basically the trade deadline in 2015 when he went to the Pirates. So the last three full seasons, he has been a number 2 starter or better. 2-3, like you said. And you know, that's something that every team, especially the Yankees, can use when it comes down to the playoff time. I mean, relievers and starters, there's no team in baseball that doesn't want one. which makes a big market. Whereas third baseman, which is what Donaldson is and Machado is, well, he's also a shortstop, but you know, the teams that are the winning teams usually don't have a huge need of those spots.
Yeah, they may already have a position of strength there, and you're not trading for a rental to shove some guy over to another position or to try and put him where he doesn't belong. So I totally understand what you're saying. So yeah, J-Hap is a big piece. If Marco Estrada, again, he's got a couple more turns to prove that he's still Marco Estrada, you know, magician, then he is also a quality piece, not as much as Hap. I don't know who the Jays can move in this bullpen other than if Roberto Osuna is off of his suspension. Maybe the Blue Jays don't want anything to do with him.
Well, I don't think they would trade him in that spot. They'd probably just keep him on suspension and restricted list and deal with that again in the offseason, because you're going to get 5 cents on the dollar, right?
Yep.
So, and they could get pieces for, you know, like minor prospects or reliever prospects or something for, you know, O and Axford and maybe not Clippard. I don't know about that. But then you got other pieces that could be dealt, like Justin Smoke, who's under contract for next year, so his value would go up. Yeah, there are pieces they can move to actually really accelerate getting stronger again for 2019-2020. And it'll be really interesting to see how they do that, because this is really going to define the next generation of this team.
Yeah, but definitely the 2019 team is not going to be able to look anything. I can't see it, that them worrying about quote-unquote the core anymore, because clearly those ingredients have not been able to come together into a successful recipe, whether because they're on the disabled list or because they just can't put together a string of wins. But that's where we're at.
Yep.
And unlike last year where it was like, well, we can maybe make one more kick at the can, I think it's everything points to some of those young kids in the minors really pushing guys like Alford and Vlad and you know, some of the new names that we're starting to hear come up, really pushing at the door to be part of the next core, which is good, because you don't Indeed. Want the oldest team in Major League Baseball.
It's usually not a good thing.
That, I think, sums up our first segment. So we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back with your questions after this. And we are back, and I gotta be honest, you folks did not seem perhaps as engaged as on some other weeks, even with that home sweep. I think that got washed away by that other sweep in Tampa Bay. But your questions, we will still answer them.
Time now to hear from our listeners.
That just seems silly.
Here are the rules. First, I ask a question, then you ask a question.
Now, how does that sound, sweetheart?
Could you repeat the question, please?
All right. So our friends at Bird's Eye View Baltimore, this isn't a question, but it's probably worth noting. When you tweeted out, you said, and while the Jays just got swept, it was technically a winning week. And their response was, thanks, Orioles. So I do remember being on that end of things back when the Blue Jays were really bad in like 2013 and even 2012. My answer to most things was the Blue Jays are here to help, especially when someone was in a slump and faced a Blue Jays pitcher and suddenly had a 4-for-4 night. We were there to help a lot.
Yeah, that's definitely the Orioles this year. The Orioles are 19-48.
It was a good year, 1948. the last time they said the last time Chris Davis had an extra base hit, or since the last time Chris Davis had an extra base hit, someone went on and they did all of the things that have happened, and Mike Trout has 7 home runs, Jose Altuve has like 27 hits. it was just brutal. It was like, wow. And Chris Davis isn't maybe even the biggest problem on the Orioles right now. I think that's probably their pitching.
Yes, the Orioles pitching is terrible. That 4-year contract for Alex Cobb is looking great.
Good Lord. All right. Let's talk about Colleen, who stays with this team through thick and thin. I admire that. And she stays with us as well. So her question this week probably for you, Josh. Do you think Biagini is fixable as a relief pitcher? And why are they keeping him with the major league team? I am perplexed why Meza was optioned and not Joe last week.
So the second question first, I think it was just mostly about his ability to go multiple innings, which means that isn't that guy, and they don't really have that guy on the roster. And just with some of the stuff that had been going through with their rotation, and you know, even some of the good starts were a little shorter, they wanted someone who could bridge them to the end so they don't kill, oh, Clippard, Axford, Tapera, because they've been throwing a ton of innings. So I think that's the reason there. As for the first part, is he fixable? I think the answer to that is yes, but I think he needs to go back to the minors to really work on some stuff, because his velocity's been up and down. Even in the bullpen, it has been higher since when he was a starter, but I think he needs to go down there away from the pressure, because he's given up runs in all but two of his outings in the bullpen, and that's just, it's not doing him any favors in the big leagues.
I think Joe has gotten, if any guy might get in his own head, I think Joe Biagini comes across as one. I think he just needs to just let it fly, right? And he might be afraid to do that at this point because he's given up a lot of home runs in the bigs and on a couple of meatballs too.
Yeah, and he's sort of been like messing with four seams and sinkers and changing his repertoire around like back and forth from one outing to the next. And that's not a really easy way to succeed, which John Axford will tell you, and he has told me specifically, it's a lot easier when you just trust what you've got and stick with it and know that this is your best stuff to get people out. And he hasn't been doing that. He's just still tinkering. And that's just, again, you can't do that at the big league level very easily.
So our next question is from Blue Jay Way at Blue Jay Way 1. Is Tulo still alive?
Well, we talked about this in the opening segment, but go ahead, Greg.
Signs point to yes. Is he still a base?
Easy. Check back later.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what to say to that. I mean, is he a baseball player? That's less certain than he's alive.
Up for debate.
At this point, maybe Taz can play for him. Is that his little kid's name? Who's like,
it is, yes.
Yeah. Maybe Taz could come and take a few reps, do something. Oh, man. Yeah, that's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes sometimes. So, I have a do-over and a gold star all rolled up into one for you. So, John Axford made a throw home. What was it, home, really?
It was in the general vicinity of home.
This looked like 50 cents first pitch. So John Axford, he had a ball hit right back to, or was it wild pitch, or was it, it was just a wild pitch, wasn't it?
No, it was a comebacker.
It was a comebacker.
He picked it up and dropped it twice in a row.
Yeah, and then when he finally came up with it, he did an overhand throw, but he gator armed it, and it went. He airmailed it past Luke Maley. Couldn't handle that, and two runs scored on that play. A ball that went what, 30 feet?
Yeah, it should have been a force out or a double play. Instead, it was not.
Yeah, so we're gonna give you the do over there. You get another opportunity to try and make the throw, because holy moly, that was pitiful. However, John Axford, good Canadian boy that he is, I think he managed to redeem himself, because he came up and then on Twitter he said, "I have the tweet," and then of course,
has anybody made a gif of that horrible throw I made last night yet?
So, he knew it. You know what? I haven't played either the Gold Star theme or the Do-Over theme. Should I play them over top of one another? No, that probably wouldn't do too well.
I think we just give the Gold Star.
Okay. Gonna be nice.
I think that's rather brilliant.
So I did good, right?
I mean, I would have thought you'd get a Gold Star.
You enjoy that. You've earned it.
Yes. So he owned it. He even has a facepalm emoji.
Yeah. And then the road guy, one of the Blue Jays Twitter guys, was one of the first replies, and he said yes, and he put someone's first pitch. I can't remember whose it was, and it's airmailed. John Axford, the closest yet, was his response.
There's Carly Rae Jepsen. He objects because she spikes it, though it is in Tampa, so they're in the right place. Yeah, there's a
There's a lot of... We even have Monty Python attempting to throw the holy hand grenade as an impression of what John managed to do. So I guess I would feel better if more players owned the stupid plays. Like, I know you're professional, I get it, but that's not a play that you're really used to making as a pitcher, because you're worried. I think in that instant you've already juggled it three times and you're thinking, man, if I throw it too hard, I'm gonna ping it off his chest protector. So you try and ease up a little bit, and then all your mechanics go out of whack.
Yeah, it's just baseball stuff, but having the good humor about it, that just makes things a lot more fun, and it probably makes him a lot easier to overcome on his side too, from the mental aspect. It's like, you know, when he's engaging with the fans about it, it's not people like, oh my god, you suck, you know, right?
Yeah, there was one guy in the replies, and I called him out, who basically told Axford, you know, you need to do some things to get hitters out.
Like, oh yeah, I saw that.
Did you just well actually a guy who's been in the bigs for 10 years about how to get hitters out? Was that necessary? Did that help anybody? So I liked all the people who just had fun with it. So it's still possible to have fun with a little bit of losing. Now, are you ready?
Nope. We'll do it anyway.
All right, we'll play the theme.
Stump the Swap.
No, it's Josh.
Oh, that's a bad guy. You don't want to fool with him.
And somehow I fool with you every week. Okay. So, let's first talk about Ted Williams. Ted Williams. Okay. This is why I think I accepted the question, why it hit a soft spot. But Ted Williams is one of my favorite players ever. And I think he's the greatest hitter who ever lived. Not the greatest baseball player, but certainly the greatest hitter. Do you know what Ted Williams' career on-base percentage was?
Oh, it was somewhere like 470 or 480 or something like that.
482.
That's not bad.
So this is his entire career he spent getting on base almost 50% of the time. Before people thought a walk was worth anything. But now, since Ted Williams retired, there have been four players who have managed a single season, or in some cases multiple seasons, where they had an on-base percentage better than Ted Williams' career on-base percentage.
That's how good. Four players have done that?
Only four players have ever had as much as one season. So here is the question. Now, one of those players is tangentially Jays related.
Okay.
Can you name the four players who had a single season or more than one with an OBP over 482?
Sorry, so what am I supposed to be doing here? Naming
four players.
I'm supposed to name all of them. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so Barry Bonds is the obvious one.
Yes.
And this is since Ted Williams retired?
Since Ted Williams retired. Now, this question, by the way, is from Andrew Rushper, at A Rushpler.
Okay.
Just I didn't tell anybody that, and I feel like people who go through the trouble to submit a question should get a shout out. So, yes, you have Barry Bonds, who very obviously had multiple seasons where he exceeded the 482 requirement.
Yeah, I think he did it like four times in a row or something like that.
Yeah.
But, okay, so I think Norm Cash did it.
That was the one I thought you would think was tough. Norm Cash did it in 1961. That's correct.
Okay, what was the... Is there a plate appearance minimum in this? Because I know Mark McGuire did it, but he did it in like 300 plate appearances or something.
No, it's qualified batters.
Oh, okay. No, I can't think of any of the other ones right now. They were over 482.
So there's one who was a Blue Jay.
Okay.
He didn't do it as a Blue Jay, obviously. We'd be talking about that like crazy.
Can you give me a better hint than that?
So he is a recent inductee into the Hall of Fame.
Oh, okay. And you fact checked this, right?
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, I guess I'll need it because I don't have any idea who this could be.
He did it in 1994.
1994 would be Tony Gwynn?
Nope.
He has no Blue Jays connection.
Nope.
Hmm.
You may have just been stumped, Josh. On the Blue Jay player, ironically. Frank Thomas had an OBP of 487 in 1994.
Oh, yes. I don't think of him as having a Blue Jays connection. That's so funny.
Now, number four was also a guy who had a very good year in 1961. And was a Yankee.
Was it Mickey Mantle or Roger yes. Maris?
Mickey Mantle. Mickey Mantle actually had the OBP, though, in 1962. So, congratulations.
Yeah. Yep, I got stumped.
Andrew, you have
stumped. Of course,
stumped,
it's not really
Josh.
A Blue Jays question, which is kind of the point.
My
obscure knowledge relates more towards the Blue Jays than to baseball in general, though I do have some command of that. And, you know, I got...
You got Norm Cash. I was just like, what? So,
I was reading about Norm Cash recently, so that's why I knew that one. But, yeah.
Well, folks, you can make
it. It's a stump, but it's, you know.
It is what it is. I understand your frustration with that, but I appreciate all the questions. So, again.
This was like when Jay Jaffe was like asking me, like, who was the player selected in the Rule 5? I'm like, that's not Blue Jays.
I am happy though to consider all kinds of questions. I have a couple from one of our regular listeners, which I actually think might be too easy, but certainly tweet at me. I will add you, and then you can direct message me and let me know what you have for Josh again about a Blue Jays player or a Blue Jays statistic, and we'd be happy to take your questions and delve into a little bit of Blue Jays history. Now I turn to you, sir, for a final thought.
Okay, so this is kind of a goofy thing. Recently, we've been talking about obviously how futile the Blue Jays play has been. Now, one thing that's not been at least the case is that when they've had these dominant starts, they've been losing. Jacob deGrom just completed his fifth straight start, allowing two or fewer earned runs in seven innings or more in which his team lost.
It's brutal.
Randy Johnson's the only other player since expansion to have done that.
They've messed up all over the place.
Yep.
All-star balloting was released this week, the first round of votes, and the Blue Jays have no players in the top five of any of the position player categories. So in case you thought the Blue Jays were doing all right, which I don't think, if you listen to this, you really thought... Other than the rather tongue-in-cheek Luke Maley mail-in vote, I don't know that I would put any of the Blue Jays position players in the top five either, and that might speak to what's really going on with this team.
I can't see an argument for any single one of them.
That's not good. So if J-Hap doesn't get traded before the All-Star break, I think he's the Blue Jays' lone representative at this point, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if there's one team where there's a no-brainer all-star selection, it's the Blue Jays with J-Hap. And just for the record, when we're talking about this Blue Jays no-brainer all-star, this isn't a guy who's going out there with, you know, as, you know, like a starting pitcher with an ERA of 2.5, as you see across, you know, Justin Verlander's like 1.5. J-Hap's ERA is 3.48, which is good, but it's not... Not amazing.
Yeah, and that's after two starts of not allowing any earned runs.
Yeah.
Oh dear. It's going that way, folks. Hopefully we have egg on our face by the end of a podcast 2 weeks from now and we're talking about what the Jays should buy at the deadline. I hope for that. I sincerely do. Oh, which is to say that you have been Joshua Hausam at Joshua Hausam, and I have been Greg Wisniewski at Coolhead 2010. And this has been Artificial Turf Wars episode number 105. And we'll talk at you next week.